You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. And to those of you who are just at our workshop, hello again. My name is Christina Kwok. I am a fellow at the Center for Universal Education here at Brookings. And it's my pleasure to welcome you all here as we launch our report and a forthcoming policy brief, both outcomes from a research collaboration that we did with the Christian Michelson Institute. So today's presentations and panel are a continuation of discussions that we've had here at Brookings over the last couple of years, examining girls' life skills education. I think many of you in the room today are probably very familiar with the concept of life skills and the broad impact that it has on girls' lives around the world. While it has become a regular part of our toolbox when working with marginalized girls to help improve their life outcomes, there have been very few cross-country studies that actually look at the design and the approach to life skills programming in non-formal learning environments. So our first speaker today is Kendra Dupuy, a senior advisor and researcher at the Christian Michelson Institute and at the Peace Research Institute in Norway. And she'll be presenting the findings from our research, which aim to explore the landscape, the design, and the intended outcomes of non-formal life skills programs in Ethiopia, Tanzania, and Lebanon. So if you will all join me in welcoming Kendra to the stage.
Okay, thank you very much. And I would first of all like to thank Brookings, and particularly Christina and Helen and your team for an excellent collaboration and all your work and patience. So thanks a lot. And there's a lot of people here, so thanks for coming very much. Especially, I traveled a long way from Norway, so it's always my fear to show up to an empty room. Okay, so, as Christina said, I'm Kendra. I have a funny last name, so just call me Kendra. And I come from a research institute in Norway called Christian Michelson Institute. And I wanted to just tell you briefly about this institute because it is very small and you probably have not heard of it. It is a small, small compared to Brookings, small research institute based in Bergen, Norway, on the beautiful west coast of Norway. And we are an independent social science development research institute. We carry out applied research for policy influence, and what we're primarily concerned with is how to reduce poverty and improve human rights in developing countries. We carry out research that involves both quantitative and qualitative methodologies, and we have an interdisciplinary research staff from many social science disciplines and humanities. We have expertise in a number of areas, so including poverty alleviation, health, education, gender, anti-corruption, resource management, and public financial management. So together with Brookings, we collaborated to produce the report that I'm going to present today, and which is found online. And the main point of this report was to look at the current states of non-formal life skills programs that serve adolescent girls in low- and middle-income countries. So we had three more specific research questions, which were, first, what is the landscape of life skills programs for girls in developing countries? How are these programs designed? And what outcomes do they intend to achieve? So what was the motivation for this study? So our background research told us that there are few existing studies of what types of a non-formal, and by non-formal I'm talking about the non-formal education sector, so what types of non-formal life skills programs that exist specifically for girls in low-income countries, low-income, middle-income countries. So these programs should be quite good for girls because girls, they're living in contexts of poverty, often lack access to school and to good quality schooling, and are discriminated against. So these programs should be quite valuable for them. And the non-formal sector is a key arena to reach disadvantaged girls in these contexts. But we found very few cross-country studies of these types of programs, and there are very few existing rigorous evaluations of their impact and their design. So we wanted to know more about what's really going on in this field. So I want to take a moment just to set the ground here, to lay out the ground in terms of what we mean by life skills. And this was one of the first things that we found out, that there is no agreed upon definition of what life skills means. Now, there are accepted and widely used definitions of life skills, but no one has decided that this is it. So in the report, we put forward a definition. And we say that life skills is the combination of skills, or what one has, knowledge, what one knows, and attitudes, what one believes, and values, that constitute a set of competencies, what one can do, that enable youth, that enable youth to adapt to, function, and thrive in society. They enable individuals to translate knowledge and attitudes into specific behaviors that allow young people to cope with, navigate, and transform life's challenges. So maybe just a summary is to think of them as competencies that transfer to other situations. And often in the literature, they're sort of put in this bucket of everything that's not academic, therefore it's a life skill. So different types of life skills, there have been some categorizations across these different definitions of life skills we located in the literature. So one grouping are social and interpersonal skills. So these are about relationships with other people. How do people manage those relationships? This includes qualities like having respect for other people, an ability to work in teams, being tolerant, being able to cooperate, communication skills, and conflict resolution skills. A second category is what we're calling personal skills. So it's this management of yourself, including emotions management, self-regulation, perseverance, self-confidence, and self-awareness. And a final third category are cognitive skills. These are analytical abilities. So things like problem solving, goal setting, future planning, organizational skills, critical and creative thinking, decision making, and something more, a little bit more specific, health skills. So how did we carry out this report? So we had a mixed methods approach that proceeded in several stages. So first of all, we carried out a comprehensive literature review on this topic, and we came up with quite a number of documents that we reviewed. We then went out and collected original data in three countries. This was Ethiopia, Lebanon, and Tanzania. And the reason we suggested those, selected those countries was that the team of researchers involved from my side at CMI have in-depth knowledge of these countries. And then also, these are countries in which life skills programs are prioritized by the government, and I'll talk more about the countries and the specifics on that. And there are NGO programs specifically that are life skills programs. So we knew we would have data. And so our data collection methods, we first mapped out existing life skills programs that target or involve girls, and we found 103 programs across these three countries. We then conducted a survey of program beneficiaries or participants and program administrators. So the survey ultimately, the sample was 779 adolescent females and 54 project managers across the countries. And we focused on programs where life skills are taught through youth clubs as a way to focus our data collection and ensure that we found something consistent over the three countries. And finally, we had a small number of qualitative interviews to follow up on the survey, and this was about 30 participants. Okay, just briefly, what did we find in the literature review? So besides the lack of a definitional consensus, there are a few existing rigorous evaluations of programs and their impacts, and they generally show positive outcomes for female participants. And these outcomes are many and varied, but evidence has been collected and generated for several of different outcomes, including psychosocial and attitudinal outcomes, So, for instance, changed views on gender roles and improved self-confidence. There is evidence that life skill programs help to increase and improve health and sexual and reproductive health knowledge and practices. Evidence that life skill programs help girl participants to improve relationships with spouses and community members. Evidence that these programs have led to prevention and reduction of early marriage. And finally, that they have helped female participants to improve their economic and cognitive skills. So we have grouped our findings into three areas of inquiry that match, of course, to our research questions. So first of all, in terms of program landscape, this question we have about program landscape, so the specific questions that we asked in this area were, what kind of non-formal life skills programs are being implemented in developing countries that benefit adolescent girls? Who do they serve? And what teaching methods do they use? Okay, and our first finding was that the programs on which we collected data, they don't always serve the most vulnerable, nor do they exclusively target girls. So how did we define vulnerability? So this we defined as if a girl was orphaned or disabled or a dropout from school, poor, displaced, and or not living with their parents. So once we took those factors into account and looked at what kind of participants were in these programs, we concluded that they are not serving the most vulnerable. 84% of the programs in our sample are serving both boys and girls, and they recruit any and all youth. They generally don't use any background criteria other than age. Many of the participants were recently in school, and about 40% of them, when we asked how they found out about the program and why they enrolled, said they were contacted by an NGO, which suggests that either youths that are in school or have recently been in school are a fairly easily identifiable group for programs to recruit into their programs. Our survey respondents and their parents are generally educated, literate, and they are not disabled. And only 10% of programs, when we talked to them, stated that they specifically target vulnerable youth, and that just 2% actually went out and targeted vulnerable girl or vulnerable adolescent girls. Okay, but there was a bit of variation by country. So we found in the case of Lebanon that nearly half of the Lebanese survey respondents, these are program beneficiaries, can be considered vulnerable according to our definition. This dropped to 39% in Ethiopia and 29% in Tanzania. But when we looked at citizenship status, we were kind of curious about this, given the context of Lebanon, which has a lot of refugees. So when we factored that in as an additional characteristic of an additional indicator of vulnerability, the number went up considerably. And many of these programs are targeting and involving, serving adolescent refugee youth. So 88% of the respondents then were considered vulnerable. But when we did the same for the other countries, this did not change, despite the fact that there are, of course, refugees in these other countries. So, what kind of teaching methods do these programs use? So, the vast majority of them use participatory and interactive teaching methods, things like discussion, role play, drama, art, writing, sports. And program beneficiaries stated they were very satisfied with these methods. So that's really great. 75% of the programs say they use trained instructors and that they themselves actually train and regularly evaluate the instructors. And in the reports, we give examples of the ways in which they train and follow up on instructors. There were a lot of practices. It was quite interesting. Programs claim they are regularly evaluated and that they collect participant feedback. And 70% of our programs stated that they involve community members in implementation, and about half actually asked for parental consent for program beneficiaries to participate. Okay, in terms of program design, so what do non-formal life skills programs teach and why? And does context, by which we mean political, social, and economic context, shape the content of programs, and does it influence what is taught? So the programs that we collected data on report that the most commonly taught skills, or the most commonly, the skills that they most commonly teach are social and interpersonal skills. So this was about 45%, nearly half of the sample. Fewer teach personal skills, health skills, cognitive skills, and very few teach vocational skills, perhaps because vocational skills are often considered separate, but not always. So in general, program content we found is largely aligned with participant desires, what participants wanted to learn. So Ethiopian and Lebanese survey respondents, so the girls taking part in the programs, stated that social and interpersonal skills were actually the most important things that they learned in these programs. So largely a good synergy between what programs are teaching and what girls want. Just to give you a little breakdown across the countries, so about 60% of programs in Lebanon are teaching social and interpersonal skills, and a little bit less in Ethiopia and Tanzania. For personal skills, so about 28% of programs in Tanzania teaching personal skills, 19% in Ethiopia, and just 12% in Lebanon. And so going back to my previous slide about the match between participant desires and what programs are teaching. So we did find a bit of a mismatch in Tanzania. So in Tanzania, just 14% of the programs we collected data from reported health as being one of their top taught skills. But 46%, nearly half of the beneficiaries, said that that was the most valuable thing that they learned from these programs. So this is something that girls really prioritize, yet programs report low reported teaching of these skills. Okay, and our final area of inquiry was, what's the point of it all? What do these programs intend for girls to learn and for the outcomes to be? So, of course, we asked programs what they intended to do, what they do, why they did things, but we also asked girls for what they thought the intended impact would be and how they anticipated the program would result in change for them. So we found that participants felt like they would have a better chance at using the skills and knowledge and things they learned in these programs in areas where they could exercise high areas of agency. Oh, should I put that on or no? Okay. All right. Extra technology. Okay. So participants felt like, they would have greater gains in areas where they had high levels of personal agency as opposed to areas where there are larger structural barriers. So what does that mean? Girls reported that they felt like the training would have a high impact on their relationships with other people, on their personal and emotional skills, so for instance, their self-confidence, and on their health knowledge and health skills. But they largely reported that they would have that the life skills training would have quite low impact on things like future employment, marriage plans, and taking on leadership roles. But there was some variation in the countries that I thought I would share with you. So across the three countries, 86% of our beneficiaries saw a high impact on emotional management. 94% of them really felt that life skills would help them with self-confidence, even higher number on respect for others, health choices, and education not far behind. But in terms of marriage choices, just 49% across the sample of beneficiaries felt like life skills training would actually have an impact on future marriage choices. And this dropped to 27% in Tanzania, 59% in Lebanon, and 64% in Ethiopia. And just 73% felt that there would be a positive impact on future employment choices. So these are areas where girls may not be able to exercise much agency or choice, no matter what kind of life skills or what quality life skills education they get. So in general, the participants that we surveyed are very satisfied with their programs. They view training as being very relevant to their current needs. They rank the practical usefulness as being very good or good, and they often, well, almost always said they would recommend the training to others. And participants prioritize attending the program. So we asked a lot about, you know, are there obstacles? Do you pay for transportation to come to these training programs? And the participants on average reported very few obstacles to attending. Even if they had to pay for transportation, they said, I still prioritize this and I still come. A lack of time was actually the most frequently cited obstacle as opposed to money. Okay, let me give you just a quick glimpse into these three countries because they are quite different from each other and each had some interesting things that came forward. So Ethiopia has a national framework for life skill training, and they've also designed a training manual for implementation of this framework. In this framework, they emphasize four categories of skills for life skills, so personal, interpersonal, group, and societal management. We found in Ethiopia that many of the programs are being implemented in urban areas, and that few target girls or specifically vulnerable social groups. Many of the beneficiaries are currently in school in Tanzania, or they have recently received education. So as opposed to the framework, the national framework, the programs that we surveyed reported that they taught health most frequently, followed by social and interpersonal skills. Okay, so what did the girls say in Ethiopia? So just two highlights here. So the interviewees, the qualitative interviewees, when we talked to a few girls after the surveys, reported that they had experienced improved self-confidence, communication skills, and health knowledge as a result of participating. And they really liked group discussion, especially for taboo gender and sex-related issues that aren't allowed to speak about maybe in other settings. Okay, in Lebanon, also, there is a national framework for life skills. It's called the Life Skills and Citizenship Education Framework. And it does specifically say that life skills should be targeted to disadvantaged adolescents. And here they emphasize 12 core skills, as opposed to Ethiopia, where it was four sets of skills. So a third of our programs that we surveyed in Lebanon teach more than 10 skills at one time. That's a lot, but they teach more than 10, mostly falling under social and personal skills. No programs in Lebanon reported explicitly teaching on sexual and reproductive health, and only a few actually reported teaching on health at all. 20% of the programs in Lebanon targeted girls only, and 60% targeted both boys and girls. And as I mentioned earlier, a greater number of the sample respondents were actually could be considered vulnerable. And the majority of the participants in Lebanon, when we surveyed them, are recent school dropouts. So this is probably not surprising since probably many of them are refugees. So, and there are significant problems for getting into formal schooling in Lebanon. Okay, what did the girls say in Lebanon? So, survey respondents said that social and interpersonal skills are the most important things that they have learned, and they reported positive changes in social relations and sociability. And interestingly, they said that many times they had been encouraged to take part in their training by family members and community members, suggesting that that's actually really important, that programs involve communities and families in implementation. Finally, Tanzania also has a national life skills framework, which emphasizes things like self-awareness, social and relationship skills, and cognitive skills, and it's very preventatively oriented, meaning that, we would speak more about that in the report. All of the programs in Tanzania included both boys and girls, and just slightly more than half the sample of beneficiaries are currently attending school. Survey respondents find health skills very valuable, like I stated before, but very few programs are actually teaching health skills. So interestingly, in Tanzania, when we asked girls about life skills, and what was useful for them, they started talking about vocational skills and how vocational skills, and equated this with life skills and how useful vocational skills were for them. But in general, they saw life skills training influencing their future employment and education opportunities, and that may be in part because of this conflation with vocational training. And they said that they had experienced positive changes in social interactions. Okay, so to wrap it all up, I think one of the advantages or the contributions of this report is really to lay out a new research agenda for this area of life skills for girls. And I myself think that there are, we suggest a number of research areas in the back of the report, and I've lumped these into three. Not that I think they're interesting, and so maybe that's why I put just three up here, but I think we suggest six. So the first is why and how do programs have an impact? So there's evidence they have an impact, but we want to know more about how and why. So how do girls learn skills and how do they apply them in real life? How do the various dimensions of program design and the theory of change influence outcomes? So we didn't find any studies that really specifically looked at program design and connected that to program outcome. So is skill acquisition and application of a function of skill interdependency? Many of these programs are teaching 5, 10, 15 skills together. And so it could be interesting to know more about, do you need to teach several skills together in order to see some kind of outcome? And then obviously looking more at how context shapes outcome and impact. A second area of research could be looking more at program recruitment methods and the incentives aligned with that, and whether that changes the beneficiary profile or whether very vulnerable girls might simply select themselves out of these programs and that it's not necessarily a recruitment problem. But that remains to be seen. Finally, and this is my pet rock, so looking more at the connection between formal schooling and non-formal life skills programs. So girls' education is on the policy, the world policy menu, and we know that there are the largest gendered gaps in access to primary and secondary schooling are in conflict-affected and very poor countries. And in the existing literature, there is evidence to suggest that life skills programs may help girls to stay in school, to re-enroll in school, and to improve their academic outcomes. So just an example of this, in Lebanon, one of the girls that we conducted a qualitative interview with said, "Many girls like me, after attending the program, have had a chance to return to education." So, and we also found that the girls that we surveyed, those that had had more formal years of schooling completed, felt like their life skills training would have a greater positive impact on their future choices. And just thinking back a couple of slides, a lot of these girls also said that they felt like they had high control over future education choices. So in this sense, life skills training could really contribute towards improving formal schooling outcomes for girls. I will conclude there and then welcome Christina back up and make her presentation appear or not. So, okay. Great.
All right, thank you, Kendra. So I have the challenge of trying to translate a lot of these, the great research, into policy messages, which is a topic we'll be getting into more in our panel today. So what I'm going to be presenting here are some of our five key takeaways for policy and practice that are highlighted in our forthcoming policy brief. So first, as Kendra mentioned, non-formal life skills programs appear to be targeting easy-to-reach and easy-to-identify youth and are missing a critical opportunity to serve the most marginalized girls. You also need to keep in mind that our study looked at non-formal life skills programming broadly in Ethiopia, Lebanon, and Tanzania, and not specifically at programs that are targeting girls. So there's that caveat. But even with this broad investigation, we were surprised that a majority of the programs did not use any background criteria to target program participants. And as Kendra mentioned, this translates into the majority of program participants not meeting even one condition of vulnerability, which, again, as we defined in the study, was a girl who has a disability, is orphaned, not at school, or dropped out of school, lives with people who are not her parents, or has a father who is unemployed. Given that the non-formal education sector holds a unique position to provide opportunities for skills development to populations for whom the formal education sector, classrooms, schools, government schools, has failed or cannot reach, this is particularly alarming. Marginalized girls are more likely to drop out of the formal education system due to early marriage, pregnancy, financial constraints within the home, gender norms, and so on. And education is sometimes only accessible to them through non-formal education initiatives. Second, while programs are attempting to teach a breadth of skills, there is either a narrow focus on skills for self-improvement, so things like confidence or emotional regulation, or on technical vocational skills needed for better livelihoods. There also seems to be confusion in what programs are calling life skills, as Kendra mentioned around the definition. And what we're saying, what we also have said here at Brookings is that, you know, much of this might even stem from the term itself, life skills, which tends to focus us on the skills itself, when in many times we're talking about areas of knowledge and attitudes that may need further development. And last year, we developed a conceptual framework for practitioners to help address this problem. Some of you in the room may have already seen this video. If you have, please bear with us. And for those of you who are new to this, we suggest that the definition issue can be resolved if we focus on the underlying knowledge, skills, and attitudes that constitute a broad range of competencies that enable girls to thrive. And even more importantly, the confusion around life skills, we think, can be resolved if we begin to attend to the processes in which girls can translate these competencies into empowered action in the context of mediating factors, policies, institutions, so on, that may influence whether or not and to what degree she can apply those skills in diverse real-life situations. So I will... Sorry, 1 second. Let me just, slight technical difficulty. All right. We'll come back to the video later. So, third, third, and related to this problem around defining life skills education, is how can we measure what we can't define? The life skills programs in our study are clearly being evaluated, as Kendra pointed out, but there appears to be a gap between what we want to measure and what assessments are actually capturing. Currently, there is an over-reliance on self-reported measures. It's very easy to, in a program evaluation, ask girls how they feel after having done a program intervention. But what we need more are process-oriented measures that can capture whether and how girls are actually applying these skills in concrete and ideally empowering ways. We also need longitudinal measures in order to better understand the relationship between life skills development and girls' life outcomes. For example, while a self-report measure, again, might tell us how a girl feels after a program, it tells us little about whether she has actually developed that skill or skill sets, whether she can apply it in a situation outside of the program environment or the learning environment, and to what degree that skill is efficacious in actually helping her to change or improve a life outcome that is as much dependent on the receptivity of others to her action as it is on the actual skills that she may have acquired in the program. Fourth, while policy contexts appear ripe for scaling life skills education, non-formal life skills practitioners appear to be missing a key opportunity to inform evidence-based policy. In our study, even though all three countries had adopted a national or regional framework on life skills, the priorities of the non-formal life skills programs in our study appear to be defined by other agendas, whether that's the implementing organization, donors, the communities with which they work, with whom they work. This gap suggests that there could be more done to align policy and practice. And given the proximity of non-formal life skills implementers to individual girls, their families, and their communities,
These practitioners are well positioned to ensure girls' voices, their perceptions, and their strategic needs are represented in policy dialogue on girls and skills. And this is particularly important when we think about the policy spheres where girls are easily overlooked and their voices easily silenced. Finally, our focus on non-formal life skills programs generated key lessons that actors in the formal education sector can learn about improving opportunities for girls' life skills development. Indeed, formal education sector uptake of best practices developed by the non-formal education space is paramount to ensuring that widespread systems and social change for girls actually happens. And in particular, our study pointed to the importance of three things. First, preparing teachers to act as facilitators or mentors through pre-course trainings and by providing regular feedback and evaluation on their performance. Second, it also points to the importance of equipping teachers with the tools to use more participatory pedagogies in their classrooms that help girls and boys to develop many of the non-cognitive, social, and interpersonal skills that undergird most definitions of life skills. Third, it also pointed to the importance of integrating the teaching of life skills into the curriculum in the classroom rather than to treat life skills as a separate standalone subject. So before I get to recommendations, I'm going to just play the video just so you guys can see it. If I could have some. Sure. It's on this one.
This is Aaliyah, a 14-year-old girl who loves going to school. Around the world, girls like Aaliyah encounter challenges that life skills can help them navigate. But what are life skills? They are networks of knowledge, skills, and attitudes developed over time. Together, KSA networks form competencies that strengthen a girl's ability to function, thrive, and adapt to daily realities, as well as to change the course of her life outcomes at pivotal moments in her life. Here, Aaliyah faces a new life challenge. Her parents want her to get married soon. In a situation like this, Aaliyah can draw upon her knowledge, such as knowing the benefits of completing her education, and skills such as her capacity to set goals, assess potential risk, and her attitudes on gender equality and human rights. Once activated, these KSAs enable her to formulate a set of actions that may not have been possible before. But moving from skills to empowered action isn't so straightforward. The process of translation is complicated by and influenced by mediating factors. These include agency and opportunity structures. Here, Aaliyah's boyfriend now wants to initiate sexual intercourse. But does her boyfriend recognize that she is an agent of her own life? That she can exert control over her life as she chooses? Her ability to see and make choices will influence whether she can translate her KSAs into action, like convincing her partner to delay intercourse, or to use contraceptives, or to have him leave the room. In addition to her agency, are there opportunity structures in her environment, such as policy, social norms, and cultural contexts that will enable or inhibit her opportunities and choices? In Aaliyah's case, it matters whether or not she's had the opportunity to read a pamphlet on contraception, whether there is legislation mandating jail time for perpetrators of rape, and whether she's had the opportunity to have participated in a life skills program that taught her how to communicate assertively. As Aaliyah goes through her life, her KSA networks can become weaker or stronger, but her ability to translate them into empowered action depends on more than just the life skills she develops. This translation is mediated by the opportunity structures present or absent, and whether her agency is recognized by others. Viewing life skills development and translation as this dynamic and social process will help us help girls like Aaliyah achieve improved life outcomes, as well as wider transformative social change that will influence the life and opportunities of others around her and of those who will come after her.
All right, thank you. And thank you for permitting me the extra few minutes just to play the video. All right, so our recommendations then for helping the field move forward. Sorry. All computers are so different. Okay, here we go. Let's try that again. Okay, here we go. So the first one, improve targeting of participants to reach marginalized and vulnerable girls. I think all of us, hands down, can agree on that one. The second is to design life skills programs that are more intentional and purposeful about the actual knowledge, skills, and attitudes girls need to achieve transformative life outcomes and social change. The third one is to develop process-oriented measures of life skills and to invest in longitudinal data that allows us to better see the connections between life skills development and her life outcomes. The fourth one is to build more non-formal sector coalitions to generate more evidence that will inform girl-centered policy and action. I think we'll have somebody speaking with us today during our panel who might be able to speak a little bit more on those networks, as well as our Girls Charge Network. And the last one is to create regular opportunities for learning between formal and non-formal education stakeholders to ensure wider systems change for girls. So with that, I just want to thank you all for your attention, and I'd like to invite our panelists up as we dive into a few more discussion topics. So we purposely crafted this panel so that we would have a broad representation of stakeholders in the girls' education ecosystem. So from donors to government to researchers to practitioners. So we've put people into boxes, even though we know we shouldn't do that. So please feel free to go beyond the box that I put you in. But joining Kendra and myself today are Alice Jowett, Senior Education Policy Manager at the One Campaign. And then to her left is Margaret Butler, Executive Director of Comera and co-founder of the Amplify Network, and Yolande Miller-Granvaux, Senior Education and Gender Advisor at USAID. Thank you. So this study identifies and captures issues that the broader field is experiencing. Targeting issues, measurement issues, definition issues, the need to scale, the need to encourage broader cross-sectoral engagements and partnerships. So I would like to kick off the conversation, first allowing you all to introduce a little bit of yourself and your organization, but to really get from your respective vantage points what you found might be some of the key messages that from the study that you would take away and apply that in your particular context. So maybe I'll jump around, Alice, and start with Margaret and see how you found the findings from the three case study countries particularly relevant or not to the realities that you've observed on the ground working with girls in Rwanda.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me here today, and thank you for that very rich study. A lot of great information there. My work support is sort of centered around supporting CBOs across Eastern Africa. Longer term working in Rwanda, but most recently working with organizations across Eastern Africa through the East African Girls Leadership Summit and through a network called Amplify. I am a co-founder of Amplify with actually 18 other wonderful organizations. We are working together through collaboration and shared best practices to focus on the power of adolescent girls and really try and think about alternatives to scale, community-based alternatives to scale, and sort of pushing back a little bit on the traditional model of scale and what that looks like. Lot of information within the report, and a couple of things that really resonated with me was the need for longitudinal studies. I think that as organizations, we sort of are forced to fit within a grant cycle. To provide results within a grant cycle, instead of sort of looking at the long term, you know, what does transformation mean for a young woman? And how do we go beyond a 3-6 month or a year long grant cycle? Because I don't think ultimately you're going to see the impact of life skills or training on life skills until you know, a young woman starts making choices in her life. You know, the other piece is I think life skills are challenging to define, as you've found, because context matters. Life skills are going to be different across communities, countries, regions. And I think we have to really pay attention to that and the contextual piece of it. And finally, you know, I guess I loop back to sort of the donor piece around reaching marginalized girls. That takes time, and it also takes a lot of money, and it also takes, you know, young women from marginalized settings require intensive interventions and long-term interventions. And a lot of organizations, and I'm not saying that this is right or wrong, they are committed to a year-long grant cycle. So how are we going to get great results quickly, right? Like that's the reality of it. With the most marginalized young women, you have to spend the time, you have to spend the money to be able to support them in a very rich way. So those were some of the pieces that I were sort of spinning around my head as I was reading this report.
Thank you so much, Margaret. Yolande, what about at USAID? What have you observed in the programs that you all support?
I will skip the "what does USAID do" question. If you have questions later, let me know. But this is the U.S. government, so you can imagine that we do everything in education. But I'm in the Office of Education at USAID. Therefore, all my remarks here are going to be focused on education-specific issues. I love the study. If you have not read it, especially focus on the semantics issue. It was a great idea to challenge the definition of life skills. And as you mentioned, Christine, there's so many definitions of life skills. When I looked at empowerment, I have found 864 definitions of empowerment. So life skills relies, when we think about life skills, we rely on the assumption that it is related to health and not education. So the report does a great job of linking it back to learning, whether it's cognitive or non-cognitive skills. So that's a huge asset. The second strength of the report is that it is looking at the root causes of gender inequities. Because when you look at skills and life skills, when you look at knowledge and skills and attitudes, you have to go down to the level of gender norms. Because in the end, these are the root drivers of inequities. And the report does that brilliantly and in a very subtle way in all countries that have been studied. So by doing that, looking at those root causes, you can really look at norms. And then by challenging gender norms, you can challenge the delivery of life skills curriculum, which is what the report does very well.
Thank you, Yolande. So, Alice, over to you. Where do organizations like the One Campaign fit into this discussion? And how do studies like the ones we presented here today fit into the work that you do around policy advocacy for girls' education, for education broadly?
Thanks so much. So for those of you not familiar with the One Campaign, we're an international campaigning organization with 9 million members working on ending extreme poverty and preventable disease in sub-Saharan Africa predominantly. Last year, we really focused a lot on girls' education and the importance of girls' education. And we're currently looking more at the quality and skills and the integration of skills and that side of things. So that's kind of where we're connected. In terms of the work we do, we're often working on the kind of campaigning and advocacy side around the AU, the G20, and those kind of, you know, getting things into sector plans and doing that high-level policy side. We're not implementers, so that's another argument, another conversation. Again, I thought this was a... Is this not... How strange. I thought this was a fantastic report, and I definitely recommend reading it. It's really useful, particularly in campaigning and advocacy, to look at what the outcomes actually are and the outcomes can be achieved. So that was a brilliant piece. The importance of skills... the importance of context, which is often a difficult thing for people to understand, is how different these things are in different contexts. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach to this. But the other thing that's really important to me is that as what we're doing here today, and I thank you so much for inviting me to this, is it opens this conversation up of the kinds of things that we're talking about today. What do you do when you know this information? How do you get this information where it needs to get? How do you define it? What else is needed? How do we integrate this into sector plans? Who is being reached? You know, these are such important topics and something that often reports stop at before they get to this. And I think that that's a really exciting piece, linking this to that kind of wider piece that you were discussing around what the next steps are. So thank you.
Yes, and we will certainly dive into those issues because we love percolating on those things. Okay, so the first kind of topic that I wanted to get us into is really around the issue of this definitional consensus. And clearly, this is sort of a softball question to Kendra, because I think you do think it's an issue. But, you know, you found in the report that there is no definitional consensus. Is this a problem? And if so, what are the potential implications? And if not, how do we move on from this?
So I feel like I had an existential debate with myself on this morning in the shower, and I was thinking, okay, as a researcher with my research hat on, my great nerdy hat, of course it's a problem that there's no clear definition, right? Because like you pointed out, what are we measuring? It's a fundamental problem in social science research. If we can't agree on what we're measuring, we have no idea then how can we then say anything about impact or outcomes. But of course, there could be an advantage here in the sense that if context matters for determining which skills matter, then maybe we need more of a loose definition to ensure that context can still play a role in determining which skills should be taught. But I thought of two other things that might be a disadvantage in not having a better definition of what life skills are. And the first thing is that there could be implications for the quality of life skills programming. So that if anything goes, which is sort of the approach now, if it's a kitchen sink approach, then it's hard to compare programs. It's hard to know what is leading to what. And so if you're teaching 10 or 15 skills, this is my next and related point, and we make this point on page 36 of the report, so when you read it diligently tonight, you will find this in our Ethiopia chapter, that you know, there's a trade-off, and this is not just about life skills, but about learning in general. There's a trade-off in how well people can be trained in each skill. So the returning, in economists speak, the returning value to each additional skill loaded into the curriculum is probably pretty low. So, you know, clearly having a clear definition, I think, would aid in understanding what the contribution of life skills are and also in terms of quality of programs. So,
no, that's a great, great point. I'm curious to hear what the others think, especially if we see life skills as ranging from knowledge areas like maybe HIV/AIDS education to technical knowledge areas to skills like communication negotiation. What are the implications for practice and investment? Maybe Yolande, we can start with you.
Well, there are many implications, right? And I will talk about the education sector. The report has shown very clearly that we distinguish between non-formal and formal education, and you challenge bridging the gap between these two levels. That is key for us. At USAID, we have a number of programs that try to do both. So when we work, for instance, in higher education settings, we do a lot of work in Pakistan, in Egypt, in Tanzania, in Lebanon, in Rwanda, and we try to sustain the opportunity to reach higher education opportunities for girls who were disadvantaged. And we do that through scholarships, merit-based scholarship. We do that through conditional cash transfers. We do that through mentoring. We do that through work readiness programs. So the way we do it is by really integrating what we would call life skills or work readiness skills or soft skills into our formal education programs. And that would allow our girls and, I mean, young women and young men to really pursue the education. So you don't stop at secondary education. You don't stop at a non-formal education level. You keep going, and you give them opportunity to go all the way through higher education, even vocational education, depending on the countries. So it's that integration that we do at USAID that relies on the link between practice and policy that the report points out so clearly.
I go against the grain a little bit. I actually think it's a beautiful thing that there isn't, you know, a true definition around it, because I think it does vary so much. I think that you can, you know, there's probably lines that you can go draw across. Obviously, there are. But I think that again, I'll go back to this context piece, that it is going to be very different across communities and countries. And you know, I'd almost challenge that we have to come up with a new way of evaluating and thinking about, you know, maybe it isn't comparative. Maybe it's sort of saying how can we evaluate this one program or what this one community is doing with life skills and young women, and looking at, you know, on the longitudinal side of things, of like how far have they come as a community, rather than saying, okay, we're going to compare apples to apples to apples to apples across, you know, a region, when actually it's apples, oranges, grapes, and watermelons that we're trying to compare. So I would say that it's you know, I understand the need in the sort of research arena to have this joint consensus, but I'd love to think about like how can we sort of change the way that we think about evaluating these skills.
So it's as much about trying to find some underlying principle rather than necessarily defining, maybe. Alice, what are the implications then for no definition and the policy advocacy? I imagine that may be hard to message.
Yeah, that is exactly the point. Yeah. It makes it incredibly difficult to communicate and message something when there isn't a clear piece. I think the kind of quality and comparisons, it makes perfect sense. I mean, one of the things for us is, you know, we can advocate hard and campaign hard to get some language into communique language or into a sector plan, and, you know, we're very happy with the success. But if there's no consensus on what that language actually means, people can do all kinds of different things and call it that. So it's problematic from an advocacy and campaigning point of view in terms of getting people to understand it in the first place and get behind it. But then it's also really difficult from an accountability transparency point of view to say, oh, you did that, you know, and you achieved it. So I think that's really important. Another side of that is very much meeting people where they are. And when you work in education and you understand all the different nuances and all of the different ways of defining things, and these are all very different. In my day-to-day work, I'm working with people that have no background in education. They don't really understand what formal, non-formal, informal means. And I need something really simple that I can kind of go to people with, and they'll just understand it, and then we can all get on the same page pretty quickly. So, yeah.
And this is to all of you, do you all think that perhaps this lack of really knowing what we're talking about is also preventing key actors from getting into the space? So, I mean, Kendra mentioned that, you know, there are policy frameworks, national, regional frameworks around it, but when we actually think about, you know, the investment in girls' life skills education, does this lack of definition kind of preventing us from actually getting key policy makers and decision makers from getting into the field? Anyone?
Well, I'll take a stab at it. I have seen in the past, I'd say 2 years, maybe 18 months, has been a focus on social and emotional learning. And it is the Education Equity Initiative has done an amazing job coming up with boundaries, with definitional boundaries that allow us as practitioners, I'm not a practitioner, but as, you know, funding practitioners, to develop education programs that are much more easy to monitor, to manage, and to evaluate than ever before. And so I think we're seeing the light at the end of the definitional tunnel here, with a number of indices that look at the type of life skills, but which ones, which strategic life skills are we really focusing on? The youth, the positive youth development framework that we have focuses on the same type of life skills that were presented here. And we now know how to measure them and to monitor them and measure them. So I think we have come a long way, and I think we have enough now to base our education programs on. We can always do better, but we have enough now.
Right. Does anybody else want to take a stab at that? Or we can move into the next topic area, which Yolanda has given us a great segue to.
No? Okay. No other thoughts. Okay. Well, okay, so you mentioned, you know, we know what is working. We know what kind of skills. We're putting boundaries on those skills. So in the report, we talk about really needing process-oriented measures to understand whether girls are actually developing those skills. We need to have more objective measures to understand whether when the girls are learning, acquiring them in their learning context, whether they can apply them outside in real-life scenarios. Longitudinal data is another one that you raised and we raised as well. But the research also points to the unique position that the non-formal education sector has in terms of their proximity to real girls and the potential that they have then to collect very grounded girl-centered data. So I throw it all to any of you. You know, what are the implications for that? Yolande, we can start with you, or we can, since you raised that kind of that point, what are the challenges, the data challenges that we're dealing with when it comes to understanding, you know, what we need to invest in? Yeah.
Okay, so I'll start again, if you allow me. I think the global community has spent a lot of time focusing on education inputs that yield education outputs, and we measure education outcomes. And in our area of work, we have focused on how many kids can read, how many words per minute, how many disadvantaged girls have access to alternative or accelerated learning programs in crisis-affected environments, and so on and so forth. And we're just looking at education outcomes and outputs. What we're doing here now is saying, no, we need to go back to, I say go back because... to an approach that looks at the whole of girl approach, what we used to call the whole of girl, but it's girls and boys, looking at the gender dynamics, looking at the power dynamics, and looking at the balance between achievement and behavior and attitudes. And we are now finding out, and research is finding out, that if you have issues of gender-based violence, your learning outcomes are going to be drastically affected by it. Your access numbers are going to be drastically affected by violence, gender-based violence, and the lack of skills, attitudes, and knowledge, or whatever they call. And so now that this linkage is made, we have to go back to a certain extent and look how we can integrate socio-emotional learning and life skills into what we do. I'm not sure I answered your question, but at least I stated what I... what we said.
So... coming from the smaller organizational perspective, a lot of organizations and to what you're saying have been doing, community-based organizations have been doing this like deep, rich work in communities for a very long time. That there hasn't been, as you say, historically it has been focused on, you know, how many girls are you getting into school, how many girls are graduating, how many girls are, entering life skills programs and exiting life skills programs with a survey at the end. And I think now is the time where, you know, obviously I'm very, very biased in this, but I think we need to start shifting more towards looking at what community-based organizations are doing and letting them lead the conversation around what is working within the communities. And also saying, you know, what kind of support do you need in order to collect this type of data? Because there is a lot of support that is needed, a lot of money that is needed in this data, and sort of using them as knowledge holders, not as data collectors, but people in communities that know and understand the context from which they're coming and how to best collect this data and be able to show what, you know, life skills looks like or true transformation for a young woman looks like and how she's applying those life skills.
Alice, what about from your perspective at One, especially when working on trying to translate some of the data and the evidence into messages that you can amplify to policy stakeholders, what kinds of information do you see they need to hear? And as somebody coming from academia who went directly into an advocacy organization, you can see kind of both lenses. What kinds of evidence do you see are the most effective in supporting policy advocacy work around girls' education?
Yeah, absolutely. As Christina mentions, I went headfirst from academia straight into campaigning and advocacy. So the difference between a 10-page report versus one powerful line with a stat in it is it's quite a different different way of seeing things. One thing that I've really learned from being at the One Campaign, so the One Campaign has a 5 P's model in all of the work that they do. So policy, politics, public, pop culture, and partnerships. And the big thing is you have to meet each of those people where they are. So everyone's going to have their different needs in terms of what is going to resonate for them and what is going to, you know, be a powerful message for them. So again, it's this meeting people where they are. So at One, we're always looking for stories. So for your kind of layperson, a story of a specific girl and the journey that they went through on a blog or a specific program and the amazing things that program did, and that kind of gets buy-in. We're always looking for stats and that one line with a shareable number that gets buy-in. A big thing is the need for the elevator pitch. If you can't say it in a few minutes and really get your argument across, you're going to lose the interest of policymakers pretty quickly. So you kind of have to start out with your action and your ask. The audience have to find it immediately relevant. So there's got to be an immediate win for a policymaker, for example. Is it something that they're already working on? Can you link it back to a wider goal like the SDGs or the CESA strategy if you're in Africa? Or is there, like in the literature review, is there a societal aim that you can say this contributes to and then you can tie it into that agenda and then it's a win there? So one example from the work that I did when I first joined One was taking the very complex thing that is at the education sector and then trying to make it into kind of a punchy, interesting pitch that you can bring across, which we called Make Education Work for Every Girl. Break every barrier, monitor every outcome, invest in every teacher, connect every classroom. And it sounds so simple and punchy and easy, but actually anyone that works in education knows these are huge issues and pretty much cover all of the different things that you can come across with education. But what we've found is it's memorable, people pick up on it, and then we find policymakers actually including some of this language when they're doing their work. So it is effective. It's very different from my kind of academic background where I wouldn't dream of having lines like that, but it definitely works in the advocacy campaigning space.
So, Yolande, you mentioned the whole girl-centered approach, kind of trying to capturing all kinds of data points that could then be taken up by policymakers. Margaret, you talked about the need to really increase the capacity of local knowledge keepers to be able to present what they see on the ground to policy advocates or to policy stakeholders and policymakers. It seems like when we're talking about, you know, the research, making it accessible to policymakers, there's a timeline challenge here, a timeline issue. So within girls' life skills education, there's clearly a huge momentum around it. It's buzzy. People kind of can get it, why girls might need it. But the challenge is conducting studies that can generate evidence needed at a pace that policymakers need in order to do what they need to do, in order to see the win that they need at this particular moment, right? And this is particularly challenging when it comes to trying to invest in and generate longitudinal evidence of the impact of life skills education for girls. I'll go to Kendra to hear your thoughts on this challenge. You know, what's the potential feasibility? What are some of those timeline challenges in conducting studies at a speed in which policymakers need the information? I mean, do we just need crystal balls and be able to like predict in 2 years' time what policymakers want and have the studies ready?
Well, crystal balls and giant research funds, those are my dreams. In the absence of that. So I was thinking about this one too. So what could be maybe an approach is thinking about a research program around life skills where we think about both the short-term outcomes, and many of these programs that we looked at are very short-term in nature. So they're maybe, you know, one-time meeting or 3 weeks or a month. So you could actually measure outcomes from these programs that are relatively short in duration and look at short-term outcomes. But then you really do need the funding and the research architecture to look at longer-term outcomes and get at these questions of transformation. So I think you can win over policymakers who need quick results, but they also need quick results to keep momentum around research. So There also has to be funding and willingness to collect data over time and space, and an understanding, of course, that the processes we're looking at, you know, you can look at them over time and at single moments in time. And maybe a little bit more openness to thinking, you know, appreciating context in the way that Margaret has been pushing for and saying that maybe not everything is always scalable or can ultimately work everywhere, that sometimes there are limitations, and that's actually a good thing, that people are not the same everywhere. They share many qualities, but, yeah, not the same everywhere. But, yeah, maybe more of a focus on what we can study in the short term and what needs to be done over the long term and how to build the short-term research into a longer-term program. But that might be my pipe dream, too.
Yolande, from a donor perspective, what are your thoughts on that?
So I want to talk a little bit about what DFID has done in terms... I shouldn't, but I will. Because in terms of research, they have done a brilliant job looking at skills from an early age all the way across several education cycles. So they've been able to look at the girls, talk about longitudinal. We're looking at years and years of tracking the achievement, and not only academic, but you know, non-cognitive and cognitive achievement of these girls across, you know, at least two cycles of education, primary, middle school, and up to secondary. At USAID, we are developing a gender framework that is going to hopefully allow us to do just that. So looking at developing a set of socio and emotional skills, learning skills that are applicable at the early grade reading level. So take the little kids and keep applying it all the way through higher education. So I don't know that I will have the funds to monitor and evaluate and give you that big, you know, that big pot of money that researchers need to do, but we're certainly working on it. In any case, we recognize that the evidence has to be following a thread across the spectrum of development. Because at USAID, we have programs that work with early grades all the way to higher education. We have an opportunity to weave the thread of longitudinal studies for socio and emotional learning skills throughout.
Margaret, I'm curious to hear your point, because I'd also like to hear how that, like, how do you then create space for these community-based organizations to kind of insert themselves into that timeline challenge, too? So,
on top of what you're going to say. Yeah, and very briefly, my hope is that this isn't just a flash in the pan, that life skills for young women remains at the forefront for a very long time. I feel like it's... something that we have learned and continue to learn that is an imperative in the development of countries, I guess, you know, and I think reports like this provide us with rich data in the short term that can hopefully help us leapfrog to the longer term evaluation. So what we're trying to do with Amplify is to create sort of a platform or a backbone for community-based organizations that then can get access to information or best practices or training that helps them around evaluation and data and being able to sort of provide this collective gathering so that we can sort of say, look, you know, we may be little, but hey, look at this huge impact that we can have as a collective group. And so I think... being able to provide sort of networks or structures where community-based organizations can have a broader platform should be something of the future, where it's not just everyone kind of working in their own little silos here, there, and everywhere, rather than sort of saying, okay, how can we, you know, come together around this specific issue and help push it forward, and including everyone in that conversation, not just, you know, the USAIDs of the world, which are fabulous, but how do we also include, you know, these smaller organizations too?
Right, so it's not just about bringing these disparate organizations together to share best practices, but to actually work together for a common goal and to create common impact, yes. So our study was focusing primarily on the non-formal education sector, and we talk about kind of the need to scale, the policy moment to scale these best practices.
we want to see widespread change, we've got to involve the formal education sector. So Alice, you mentioned, you know, needing to kind of need those definitions around the non-formal and formal, like, you know, who are these different actors? Besides just identifying who are the levers of change for wider systems change, what have been some of those challenges and opportunities you've seen to translate some of the lessons that have been generated in the non-formal education space and translate them for actors that are primarily located in the formal education space? How do you kind of get around those?
Yeah, thanks. One of the key things is, again, I'm going to go back to definitional again, but the definition of scaling up obviously has so many different definitions. And if you're replicating a program, you don't have to take a cookie-cutter approach and replicate a whole piece. That's not going to work in different contexts. I really like what you're saying about kind of networks and building on each other and being able to do that. I think a big part of it is coming down to those key core characteristics. What are the concepts that do work in different places? And I know in the report you talk about teacher training, participatory pedagogy, involving community and families, not just being standalone, but involving skills in knowledge impartation. And I think those are more the key concepts that you can bring to scale in terms of you can talk to policymakers about the importance of them, and then those ideas can be different in different contexts, if that makes sense. So I think that that's the piece is always what are the very kind of ostensibly simple lessons that are learned and the concepts that are just really important to that programming, and then you give people an opportunity to shape that into the context that they're in. So that's kind of the direction that I would look at it, and I really like the lessons that are learnt there. The challenge then is trying to get the policymakers to take these on. So you've got the one challenge of the Minister of Education that obviously has an awareness of what education is and does and all the rest of it. But then you've also got to get the Minister of Finance on board. And often when you're talking to ministers of education, they say the really big thing that an international actor can do when they come into the room is they bring the Minister of Finance with them, because there's an interest suddenly from the Minister of Finance. Then you've got to find out how to message it in a way that the Minister of Finance is also going to be interested. So they're kind of some of the areas that we look at.
Margaret, what about for you and Amplify? You talked about kind of horizontal scaling and trying to take lessons beyond one maybe isolated community and bring them across many communities. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe even the public-private partnerships too?
Absolutely. So we are still very much in our preliminary stages and are developing and working on this network. The perspective that we bring to adolescent girls is that we have to include all actors, and all actors being, you know, organizations that are working in health, organizations that are working in education, organizations that are working in economic empowerment, schools, non-formal organizations, community-based organizations, grassroots organizations, more established organizations, and funders. How can we create a network where we're able to work across sectors? And I think that that is going to enable us to really sort of truly understand the value of or what interventions are needed for adolescent girls and be able to draw out some pretty interesting pieces, even though it is in different contexts or across different countries or communities. So for us, the cross-sectoral piece is very important, and we're sort of evolving around that right now. And it's interesting conversations. You know, how do we have really open and honest and frank conversations with funders as organizations around what's working and what's not working? And how do we develop with organizations the evaluation criteria or how we want to evaluate ourselves around, you know, life skills? And I may have come across as saying, like, you know, we don't need a definition of this. I do think we need a definition of this. I just think we have to go through the process of, and obviously we are going through the process and sort of figuring out what it looks like. The journey is really important in this piece, and we can't just sort of say, okay, this is what it is.
Yolande, you mentioned specifically the work with USAID trying to make sure that any sort of skills focus is integrated into both non-formal and formal education sector programs. So maybe, because that's one of our recommendations and one of our policy implications from the study is really needing to create more of those opportunities for learning. But USAID is kind of targeting it already at the get-go. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that approach and how you have seen things work across the formal and non-formal education space or maybe not working that we could better attend to?
So it's a very complex issue, right? So I told you earlier about the integration that we do well. When I want to touch on the scaling up and the cross-sectoral, if that's okay. In terms of cross-sectoral, I mean, is cross-sectoral planning and programming and implementation the key to scaling up? Yes and no, depending on the context. As Margaret said so clearly, community-based organizations tend to be better placed than large-scale organizations to do life skills and to do socio-emotional learning. And at USAID, we try to do both. So we work with governments to work on the three R's, and then we rely on our implementing partners to work at the project level, really at the project level, to work on such skills. So how do you bring that together? And that's where the issue of scale comes up and cross-sectoral work. USAID has been very successful at getting to life outcomes and education outcomes and health outcomes in programs where we have integrated health, child protection, education, and sometimes PEPFAR, HIV/AIDS funding together in the same community. We have great programs on that. Malawi, Tanzania, lots of examples. Cross-sectoral work has been done just very well with lots of great results. How sustainable is it? You've been in the field. We work with the Ministry of Youth and the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education and the Ministry of Gender and the Ministry of Social Protection. And you go on and on, and they all need a piece of the pie. How do you manage it? It's extremely difficult for donors and the global community to do that in country. And I won't go into details, but we all agree that we should be working cross-sectorally. At the national level, it's extremely difficult to do, let alone bringing the finance minister to come, and he's got, usually it's a he, who has the funding to do that. So very difficult. One opportunity that I see is taking the gender lens and looking at gender mainstreaming and gender budgeting. If we could all do that, if we could all set aside resources for gender budgeting, then issues of life skills and issues of socio-emotional learning tightly linked to academic and 3 R's type of education and instruction will be so much easier. So it's the... we're going to get there. It is new, but our European partners know how to do it well, and I think that may be the key to or one of the entry points to succeeding at this level. Yeah.
Right. No, you raise an important point. I mean, it's not like we're saying that the formal education sector needs to take on what the non-formal education sector is doing. There's clearly comparative advantage in terms of what content they're delivering and in what spaces they're delivering. But how do we better ensure continuity? Right, continuity and the opportunities that girls have to learn and develop and apply these skills across different spaces and across their lifetimes. Right, so I want to see if any of you all have comments to each other on any of things that we've talked about so far, and then throw it out to the audience for a couple of rounds of questions before we come back to the panel again. Any comments? No. Over to the audience. Wow. Okay. So we have 3. Okay. We have mics 4. Okay. So we'll do the four individuals who have raised their hands, and then if each of you could ask your question, we'll then go to the panelists to respond, and then we'll go for another round of questions. If you could raise your hands again, we have right here.
Thanks. Hi, my name is Smriti Patel, and I'm a leadership coach. I work predominantly in the corporate world, so you may be thinking, what on earth is she doing over here? This is a passion of mine. So first of all, I just want to make a caveat and just say that this is all very new to me. So if my questions are a little naive, please excuse me. I also want to say that this is an incredible panel that's been put together because it just brings a great practical perspective as well as the donor and the policy perspective as well. So a couple of things. First of all, I am quite struck that when I was looking at your slides, Kendra, that Tanzania has made this a priority in terms of its framework. So I'm and in particular, the piece around awareness being a priority. So I'm really quite struck by that. And my question is that what is it that has a country prioritized that? I'm Kenyan, so I'm curious to know whether you guys have any information on Kenya in particular. Lastly, I'll just say that the definitions of the definition of life skills that you have at the moment, I can tell you that there are lots of corporate executives who I work with who are struggling with those same life skills. Thank you.
Hello. So my question is a bit more targeted for towards Margaret, as you're more of an implementation, seems like, person. To give some context to my question, I work for an organization called Batonga that finds and targets the most vulnerable and marginalized girls in Benin to deliver life skills and financial literacy skills in youth club format. So, sort of familiar with the topic. But as far as the targeting and finding of vulnerable and marginalized girls, if you could just talk about, and anyone else can talk about this if they feel they would like to, but logistically and realistically, what have you found to be kind of some of the more effective ways of doing that? And secondarily, since I know what Batonga does to find and target girls like that, and one of our main challenges is sustaining the membership and the participation of these marginalized girls, what have you found to be some of the most effective ways of encouraging continued participation in a repeated program that's either, you know, weekly or monthly or what have you, given the time pressures and things like that on the most vulnerable and marginalized girls?
Hi, thank you all for a wonderful presentation. It's really wonderful to see this research come to fruition. My name is Jenny Gamble, and I'm with Discovery Learning Alliance. And over the past couple of years, as part of a Girls Education Challenge grant, we have helped to establish more than 2,000 girls' clubs in Kenya, Nigeria, and Ghana. So just kind of giving that backdrop. My question is really around the link between the informal girls' clubs or associations and youth clubs and the value that they're seeing in terms of workforce development and vocational training. There seemed to be a bit of disconnect there. And just to share, so, you know, we have seen and even had exhibitions in northern Nigeria where communities are so proud of the things that their girls are learning, they're making, they're creating. They're creating, you know, they're not just developing skills, but they're also creating industry and little micro-social enterprises that are addressing food security and energy issues. So I'm just curious about, like, what kind of strategies might you have or suggest around making that linkage stronger? Because we're hearing a lot of, you know, cross-sector with lots of different ministries, but labor and workforce development doesn't seem to be one of them. And so kind of the downstream of that, because if our girls are seeing, like, I'm gaining great skills that I can put to use for my future employment, and the families are seeing that girls' education and participating in these clubs is really creating a lot more resources. You know, we're bringing resources into the community, and the girls themselves are being very industrious, and so all of our lives are bettering. How are we not making that case stronger for the girls themselves so that they see participating in these clubs? Because just from the data that you presented, it didn't seem to be that they saw the value. That if I participate in this, it's going to help me in the workforce. It's going to help me in, you know, my future careers or jobs or whatever kind of livelihood that I would have. So if you can kind of articulate some different thoughts around that, that'd be great.
Thank you. So we'll do these three first, and then we'll come back out to the audience. We'll make sure everybody gets a chance to talk. So maybe we could start with the targeting question, because that we did not talk about that in the panel today, particularly around what might be some effective approaches to not only targeting, but also to maintaining participation and persistence by the girls in programs. I'd love to hear, you know, Margaret, your response to that, but also maybe Kendra, because we did in the study also look at kind of what methods or mechanisms programs were using to reach their participants. So maybe we could have the two of you talk a little bit about that first, and then we'll go to another question.
So I can speak from experience in Rwanda at Comera. So they are an incredible team of Rwandans who have deep ties in the community, both at the government level, also with, you know, religious leaders, with schools, with, you know, just across the board. And so for us, we do pretty extensive outreach within the community with very sort of clearly defined standards of, you know, what your profile should be if you enter into the program. And again, it is resource intensive to be able to find these young women. We do, they have to apply. And if they can't write or read, they come in and they do a verbal application. And then we, the staff, and it's actually a committee of local staff and a community leader and someone from our parent council evaluates the applications. Then they go out and they cull that down. Then they go out and they actually do home visits to evaluate to see if the girls are actually vulnerable see if they would be a good fit for the program. And then they're accepted into They also do an interview with the girl and a family member as well before they do the home visit. Then they do the home visit for the final group. Again, it's a smaller group that we work with in Rwanda. It's 70 young women, so it's not a massive amount of girls, but it takes time and it takes resources to be able to get, you know, to truly reach the most vulnerable. And in terms of the programming that we do, it's a win for these young women. It's not just a once a week intervention, which can be absolutely wonderful, I'm sure. But what we're doing is providing a very deep intervention with these young women, recognizing that that's what they need in order to thrive and to sort of see transformation for themselves. So it isn't, you know, and when young women, vulnerable girls especially, are coming to the program, we pay for their transport. We know that they cannot get there if we do not pay for them to get there, because they are truly vulnerable. And that means, you know, someone's losing out on food if they're coming to this program. So for us, it's a very deep intervention to reach the most vulnerable girls. But again, it does come back to those community connections of, you know, knowing and understanding where they are, how to find them, and how to best support them.
Yeah, Kendra, I just remember that's a stat from the report in terms of like 61% of the girls or something, maybe 61%, did not face an obstacle to going to the program, and maybe only 20, mm-hmm. and of those who did, 21% reported transportation.
But even that's some time. More of them reported time was an obstacle than transportation costs, and even where they said they reported paying for transportation, they still prioritized the program. So it is important. So that's good. We know that girls want to participate. They like it. So I'm just looking at our report, which you will read diligently this evening. I know all of you. So on page 30. So we asked the girls, how did you learn about the program? And 40% of them said word of mouth. 38%, this is across the entire sample of all three countries. 38% were contacted directly by the training provider or NGO. Just 8% heard about it on print or social media, and 5% through the local government office. But the thing that struck me is that, for vulnerable girls, we don't know if programs are not able to reach them, or perhaps girls themselves are not really very keen on participating, so they are selecting out of participation. So one thing could be is you could think of recruitment in more of like a social network way, that you could use former participants as emissaries to go out and recruit new vulnerable girls if word of mouth is actually a very successful way of recruiting girls in. And this way you might be able to do what programs themselves don't have the resources to, or just may not be as good at identifying vulnerable girls, is to use girls themselves. Now, I don't know how that may not always work out in the context, but could be one way of thinking about it.
I also think it needs to include families in the conversation. You know, when we first started, we weren't including families in the conversation 10 years ago, and it was a huge failure. You know, that girls were going home and being abused because they were seen as like better than, or you know, not participating in their duties at home. And once the transition to engaging guardians or family members in the conversation, once that took off, then the participation skyrocketed as well. So I think it can't just be sort of like a single intervention. It has to be, you know, how do we involve the entire family and community in this process so that everyone sees value in it as well.
Thank you. So, to Jenny's question, just in terms of prefacing before we hear from the panelists, last year we had we looked at this issue of the linkage between a focus on life skills education or some sort of life skills component within workforce development, kind of workforce transitions programs, to try to see, you know, what are programs doing that better integrate this focus on, you know, from the workforce perspective, soft skills, right? How are programs that are focused on trying to help girls transition to whether it's a formal employment or their own industries, own entrepreneurial activities. But we were surprised that there were very few workforce programs who actually were attending to the broader skills beyond the vocational and technical skills that they were targeting. So your question is particularly important, and I wonder if any of our panelists have seen that, I think part of it is, too, again, the term life skills points us to things that are different, or at least bounded to life and not necessarily to work or livelihoods. But I'm curious if any of our panelists have a response to that particular question.
I can respond. Okay, so I'm going to give a very academic answer, which is that economists have suddenly found out that soft skills are important for workforce. Yeah, so, but this is, I mean, okay, so I don't know why this is such a revolution, but there is now literature, which my favorite article is called Soft Skills to Pay the Bills. And there's been some studies of, for instance, Ethiopia, where workplaces have delivered soft skill programs. And it's been a positive outcome in terms of worker performance, able to get a job, so on and so forth. So I would recommend look more reading for you, but I would recommend looking at some of those articles. There's thankfully not too many of them, but it's an up-and-coming area of research. So,
yeah, there's also and this is good. Thank you. What I have seen is a lack of analysis of the real situation. So we come up with programs that are, you know, that have a cookie cutter approach, and we really do not engage the youth into defining what they actually, not so much the skills they want, because they, you know, sometimes they will, but it's more what they will do with the skills. They have aspirations. Are they realistic is another story. So as you know, for instance, in Egypt, we spent a lot of resources, not us USAID, but the global community, training young women with amazing skills. And the minute they get married, they will not go outside of their home. And they're looking more for opportunities to do entrepreneurship type of programs where they can be home and not have issues of mobility. We're seeing the same thing in Afghanistan. We're seeing the same thing in Pakistan. We're seeing the same issue in environments that are affected by crisis and conflict. And most of the times, because we did not really have a realistic and well-grounded assessment of what young women can do as opposed to young men. And that's where gender analysis is different. Young men are much more mobile than young women. How does that play out? And I know there have been a few studies on that, just the variable of mobility, gendered mobility is an issue. Then we could talk about the private sector, market-driven demands and things like that. That would take longer.
Sounds like someone should have worked more with community-based organizations in Egypt. Just understanding the context, not you specifically. So with workforce development, what we found is when girls are in school, we do a lot more work around life skills with them. When they're out of school, we work a lot more on income generating, on workforce development, and sort of use that as the vehicle, and then putting, life skills on top of that, because that's found to be much more appealing to young women to come out and say, okay, I can convince my family that I'm going to learn how to, start my own business or get a job or, return to education, and then layering on, the other pieces that help them thrive. We're about to start a program with teen mothers, and the vehicle for that is going to be, savings groups and, small business development, but it's also going to be a very, very rich curriculum around, agency and choices and healthcare and all of those different pieces. So it kind of like flips a little bit for us, whether or not they're in formal education or not. And it is a very, very important piece of it. I agree with you on that.
Okay, so three different pieces. One, joining in on the academic thing, I'd recommend if you haven't read Emma Padgerai's Capacity to Aspire. I think it's really, really useful around if I participate, what can I do with that and all the rest of it. I think that's brilliant from a theory point of view. From a one point of view, we did a lot of work with the three E's around the AU, education, employment, empowerment, and the importance of all of them complementing each other. So that messaging is really strong, and there's an exceptionally strong link there. And then something that we're seeing coming through more and more in the public space is the conversation around skills and skills for employment. So Jack Ma was just at DevEx talking about the future is automated. We have to teach the kind of skills you can't automate, like creativity and critical thinking. Other people like explanations of creativity because it's for entrepreneurs of the future, doing the skills for work narrative, or critical thinking, the ability to distinguish real from fake news. People kind of can get their head around it when you provide an example in that way, and it's kind of picking up some good traction. But definitely the three E's narrative, I think, is something that we can really work with. I know the WEF work with it, the AU and others. So.
Anybody have a response to or familiarity with the other countries who might have similar frameworks or interest in recognition of the importance around life skills education, as pointed out by one of our questions?
So that wasn't something we explicitly looked into. It just so happened that our three countries had these national frameworks or regional ones, but that would be a super interesting research project, both to look at which countries have explicitly adopted frameworks and then which skills they emphasize. So just in our three countries, we found a huge variation. So Ethiopia has picked four areas, and then Lebanon has emphasized 12. But I couldn't tell you why that is without a little bit more investigation, but that would be a really interesting question.
Back to the audience. Okay, we have a red jacket and a pink jacket and a yellow scarf in the front. Maybe we can take those three and then we'll go to the back again. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is so interesting. I'm Patricia Langen with Save the Children, and I come from the workforce development field. So I want to let you guys know that USAID funded an amazing systemic review of life skills programs for workforce success of young people, and Child Trends did it. So they actually found a lot of quasi-experimental and experimental studies on the topic. So if you want to see how life skills can really benefit workforce outcomes for young people, look for the Child Trends report. So thank you, USAID. But my question to the panel is, Given the limited time and money there is in the world for research, if you were going to set up a research agenda to answer some of the unanswered questions so far based on this report, what would be the number one priority on your research agenda? And you all can answer the same thing, right? So that was my question to the panel. What would your research agenda look like over the next 5 years?
Thank you. And we have the pink jacket, I think.
Hi, I'm Vasu Kamath. I'm a student from the George Washington University. And my question is based on something all of you have already sort of touched upon. Christina, in your report last year, Translating Competencies to Empowered Action, you spoke about transforming existing structures and relations of power to bring about real transformative social change for women. So it may be a little outside the scope of this report, but did you find anything specifically in these three countries where there was, you know, something done to change existing structures to ensure that some years down the line it wasn't just women versus society and it was sort of, you know, an inclusive sort of positive way forward, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you. And then the yellow scarf in front.
Hi, my name is Mary. I have a company in Brazil that works with learning program to families and caregivers and mothers in early childhood education. And we have been working with basically with corporations designing social responsibility programs. And I am very interested in learning about life skills for girls because I want to design programs to partner with these companies. And one thing that caught my attention, because we work in a very highly vulnerable areas, is that some of the programs, they were designed aligned with the skills that beneficiaries desire. And this is, I mean, from our experience working with highly vulnerable people, this is very tricky because they don't have life goals. They don't have references as we do. So before we go and explain them what they can achieve or give them examples, I mean, when we talk to kids and the girls, usually they have as a reference what they see in their community. I mean, being a teacher, because teacher is a very low remunerated job in Brazil. So what they see as an example, become a teacher or work in the construction field or even a drug dealer is as a reference for them. So it's very important that we understand first that the cultural aspect is very relevant when you design the program, because, I mean, even if we reach a definition regarding life skills, it will be different according to the settlement, the place where you want to do the program. And one example I'll give to you is that we work, for instance, in areas with high impact of construction, where when you displace a lot of workers to that place, a lot of girls goes into prostitution because it's something that the families make money and the girls make money. So my question is, how did you take in consideration the thing of they are not seeing the big picture, so they don't know what they want in terms of life skills? Second is that how we connect that to programs that allow them to transform these skills into something that is valuable to the family and to themselves in terms of income, because they will pursue that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So let's see. I think we should definitely get to the question of what is your number one question for their big research priorities. One, we should do for sure, and then we'll see if we can get to those two. Anyone?
I'm happy to start. I've thought about this a lot. You said 5 years, which is my favorite thing, is when there's a decent period of time. I would spend the first year asking all the different stakeholders what they need to know. I think that a lot of times, I mean, obviously we've learned a lot about the fact that ministers of education need this piece of information, a minister of finance needs this piece of information, a head of state needs this piece of information. But that would be a fantastic research study in and of itself. What kind of information do you need? And then I would spend the rest of the time trying to find that information. So that would be my research agenda.
Yeah, you can probably guess what mine will be. So one thing that we're looking at and talking a lot about is context. Like how do we evaluate agency across multiple different locations and what does that look like? And we're not really sure yet. And you know, what kind of mapping needs to happen? How can you know, how do you aggregate data around that? What does it look like? And so, you know, I think that would sort of be the focus area is really sort of thinking about context and how important it is and how we can, you know, truly understand how to serve and support adolescent girls in the best way, which is relevant to where they are based.
You thought we were going to give you one answer, but I mean, at USAID, we so huge, we function a little, maybe a little differently. We have a research agenda at the global level, and then missions, USAID missions in countries, you know, may have their own learning agenda as well. At the global level, we work with communities of practice. So we work with networks and organizations and academic institutions and communities of practice. And that's how a learning agenda or research agenda is decided. At the country level, it's much more specific. It tends to be related to the performance of the program and, you know, and be working with our implementing partners. If a mission feels that they need more more information or more research findings to inform their programs, then we come in and we use our communities of practice to get to these results. So that's a process that's slightly different from a community-based type of research.
Well, my question is if that comes with funding, that question. Anyways, but I already, I think, outlined, and the report, I think, outlined some very good areas of future research. And I think, you know, education is a global, it's an SDG. It long has been a global development goal, and we are still a ways away from achieving it. And understanding if life skills can help to achieve that global development goal, I think, is worth looking into. So just reiterate my non-formal and formal schooling connection.
Mm-hmm. Now, the question posed about the alignment one is also, I think, key. So the point that in the study we found that girls were reporting that the skills that were taught were the skills that they found desirable, right? And I think from our perspective, I mean, given the limitations of the study, we don't know if that is because they really desired those skills and happened to be that the programs provided them, or if maybe by chance the programs were really great at messaging around those skills and that became the reference point as our audience members spoke to. So I'm curious, from your perspective, how do we, is this just going to lead us down into the existential questions of around how do you know when we really know what people want? Or is there something more? Is it more community-based sort of community conversations and really doing needs assessments and that sort of thing? Or how do we really understand better this point of alignment in terms of program offerings and what skills girls really need and whether that makes a difference in their lives?
I feel like you just answered the question for me. No, but it is. Like you have to involve girls in these conversations. You have to involve communities in these conversations and what is relevant to them instead of sort of prescribing, you know, here we think that, you know, all girls need to, whatever it is, have sexual reproductive health training. And we're going to mandate that across multiple. It might not be exactly what they want to have. And I think we have to be able to have, you know, a conversation with adolescent girls and communities about what's relevant to them at that particular time. And that's how you're really going to get some pretty, you know, great outcomes and relevance to these young women. I mean, I think one of the things that struck me and I caught this when you were doing the presentation is that, you know, the girls were satisfied with the program content, but was it actually having a long-term impact? You know, it was sort of like, yay, this is great. We get to come participate in this program. But, you know, 70, 60% of them were saying, it had no impact on like my marriage choice. And I got probably the numbers completely wrong. And so, you know, this is sort of a roundabout way of answering this question, but I think that we must include girls in these conversations, and we must include community-based organizations in these conversations that, you know, enable them also to have a long-term impact, that it isn't just, you know, sort of a gathering space, which is very important, but also, you know, how do these translate to what you have presented at Brookings into to opportunities? You know, how do you translate that into opportunities going forward as well?
I cannot remember the name of the study that I'm going to refer to, but I'll have to look for it. But a study came out recently on the influence of social media. So even in the most remote areas, kids or adolescents do have access to internet and social media. And the study that I'm thinking of was looking at the shift in aspirations because of exposure to the internet has to offer. And that could be an entry point in the way we trying to, open the door to aspirations is by, opening the world to them, which, has its pros and cons. But anyway, that could be, social media could be one entry point. I'll have to look for that research paper. That was for girls.
Thanks. The question on the whether programs were addressing opportunity structures. Fortunately, I don't think we built that into the study because we developed the framework a little bit after the fact. But I don't know, Kendra, if you have any thoughts from the data. Like, were any programs tending to the questions around whether girls would have would be able to, learn to read their context, be able to recognize what potential levers in their policy environments might work in their favor or not? Was there any attention to some of these environmental? Yeah, that was my hunch.
Future research.
Yes, we'll continue to do that one. Thanks. Okay, we can have maybe two or three more questions, and then I think we have to wrap it up. So we've got a woman in blue, and then two hands in the back. And if you could be quick with your questions.
Mine is not a comment. It's a comment. It's not a question. I'm Aster Haragot. I'm a youth secretary, and I was girls' education advisor. And it has already been said, and what I would promote is the united system of formal and non-formal education. We cannot separate them. I think the best way to go is to have a united system of formal and non-formal education. And the basis for curriculum development must be life skills. All our curriculums should be based on life skills. This is from a long experience. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Juliette. I'm with the Aga Khan Foundation. And so we work a lot in adolescent health, and we focus a lot on kind of looking at the whole life perspective. So it's really sort of based on, when you sort of reach an adolescent girl, it not only reaches her then and sets her up for, having strong life skills, but then also she's sort of able to better take care of her kids if she's able to delay marriage or know more about health and nutrition and kind of has a more stable livelihood, all of that. So I'm wondering if in your research or just in working in this space, if you've come across other programming that kind of looks at targeting adolescent girls from that sort of whole life perspective, and if so, what kind of outcomes you've seen from that or best practices you've seen from that.
Hi, my name is Mahshid Kavari. I teach at Trinity Washington University, and my question is about climate change and the effect that it has on girls' education, especially when we talk about Ethiopia or any other developing country, but particularly in Ethiopia, when we see the effect of climate change on low-income families, farmers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have a very, very passionate person with one more hand up. Okay, we'll take one more, and then we'll wrap it up.
I went to agriculture, which is my passion. Uh-huh. So, good afternoon. Thank you so much for your presentation. My name is Rosemary Segero. We focus on my organization is called Hope for Tomorrow, and my company is called Segero's International Group. We focus on girls and women, and also empowerment, focusing on agriculture, which I was attending on the other side. Looking at the education and the skill training, we just came up with a program on apprenticeship. And the lady I work with, my partner, is working with the University of Maryland. They are just going to Tanzania to start an apprenticeship program for the young people to get skills for job creation, and especially with girls. So such an apprenticeship and skills training needs to be in all the schools, especially globally, because when the young people go out of school, they are looking for better jobs, and these better jobs are not there. They didn't have the skills training. So I think what you are doing on the girls is great. So how do we collaborate with you organizations? The research, you have done their work. The people on the ground, like Margaret, you need to work with me in Kenya. I come from Kenya. So how do we make this happen actually on the ground? I was just talking in agriculture. Civil society, there is a problem. Civil society, government, private sector, farmers, the youth, who are girls and boys. There is no collaboration, coordination, and communication. And these are the people who really need what we are talking here. We can read the report. I just came from the World Bank and spring meetings talking the same. Education, agriculture, skills training. And then we go again in summer annual meetings again. Agriculture, young people, girls. They are still down there, United Nations. United Nations. This time I didn't go to the United Nations during March Women event, because it's every year, every year, every year. So what do we really make to make the real impact, so that we don't come here again, we only read the report and go.
Thank you so much. So we have, like, we're actually past time, but I'll let the panelists maybe choose one of those questions to respond to. We've got whole life, intergenerational approaches to girls' life skills education, climate change topic, very, very close to some things that we like to do here at Brookings, and I think and others as well here, and agriculture, trying to bring it all together, making sure that we're actually moving the needle forward and not coming back again next year saying the same things.
I can take the Aga Khan Foundation question on adolescent girls. I don't know if it was intergenerational, but basically what are we doing with adolescent girls and taking that whole of girl approach. As you know, the U.S. government invested resources into a presidential initiative called Let Girls Learn that was under the Obama administration. We still have four programs that are focusing on adolescent girls, have a cross-sectoral approach and a whole-of-girl approach. One is in Malawi, one is in Tanzania, one is in Nepal, and one is in Mali. So that's, there's a lot more that we can say, but they're there.
All right. Any other comments?
So many great questions, and I want to touch on all of them, but I'll try not to. My theory is with a lot of community-based organizations, they are focused on the whole girl. You know, like that's their entire mission, and they've started because they are focused on the entire girl. And so I'll toot that horn again. And to your point about, you know, not wanting to come back here, although I love it here. It's fantastic. You guys have great coffee. Dare I be so sort of out there? I like to think of amplifying this concept of networks as a new way of thinking about systems, the old systems are it's not going to change. We're going to have a tough time changing these, like, constantly, sort of similar conversations that we're having, like, over and over and over again. So how do we start thinking about new ways to address these issues and new ways to think about evaluating these issues? And that's what I like to think about, you know, this sort of what we're trying to do with Amplify and this network model is bringing in people from the ag side, from, you know, healthcare side, from the education side, from government, from donors, from, you know, community-based organizations, that so we can start having these conversations and say, okay, what is really working, and how can we have conversations albeit pretty awkward conversations sometimes, about how we can move this forward. And so I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I like to think that maybe this is an avenue that we can start exploring more, and that there is potential for many more networks as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you all. And again, go for it, Alice.
I was just going to recommend a report that was co-authored by the person sitting to my right on climate change, which I would always recommend. Yes. So just to put that out there. I think the importance of coalitions, of networks, of making sure that we're not only donor orientated when we're having these conversations, that we're being inclusive, that we're bringing everyone to the table and having these conversations together is the only way that we're going to move forward. So thank you for that comment.
Thank you. And again, going back to then, what kind of data do we need to then inform those coalitions and inform that action? So, okay, we are totally out of time. Thank you so much for your attention and for listening very attentively to our lovely panelists and our presentations today. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your week. Bye-bye.